Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. Archaeologists in Egypt this week are celebrating the discovery of a military castle that dates to the 7th century BC. It's the kind of artifact that can advance knowledge of the country's legendary history and maybe even teach us something about its current society. Connections between ancient and modern Egypt are just some of what journalist Peter Hessler excavates in a new book called The Buried, An Archaeology of the Egyptian Revolution. Hessler is a longtime foreign correspondent for The New Yorker, who has spent much of his career reporting from China. But he moved to Egypt in 2011, just in time to witness the Arab Spring firsthand. So when he was in Boston for the launch of his book recently, I asked what it was like to experience the revolution as a Western reporter.
Looking at it from afar, we saw it as the rise of a powerful movement, a powerful revolution. But if you were there on the ground, and especially in the aftermath, what I saw it more as was the collapse of a weak state. So it wasn't so much a powerful uprising as a state that had become very weak, a regime that had no succession plan, and it was ripe for collapse and for something to knock it over. So sadly, there wasn't the sort of real grassroots movement that you needed to transform a society. And I think it was also a very narrowly political event in a society that could have used a more social revolution, the sort of revolutions like, you know, what's the role of women in this society? Is this something we can change? Or the role of young people? I mean, this was a country that you saw in Tahrir. I mean, it was more than 50% of the population was 25 or under. And these are people that are poorly educated for the most part, have few job prospects. What happens with them? Unfortunately, you know, those questions are still unresolved.
So how do those Egyptians, especially those of that age group, that generation you're talking about, look back 8 years later? What's the legacy of the Arab Spring in their eyes?
I think many people will tell you now, we shouldn't have done it, you know, which is sad. I mean, it's, you know, people will say it was better under Mubarak. They'll often say that, or that was all just a waste. You know, and so they sort of, part of the lesson, sadly enough, that they took was that it's better not to have these sort of movements. I feel like that's the phase they're in. Now, who knows? You know, maybe this will, you know, things take a while to develop, and maybe in 5 or 10 years it will feel different. But now that's what I always hear from Egyptians. We don't need any more instability. We want things to be just the way they are. They're happy with, more or less happy with, another authoritarian strongman in charge.
So let me back up to your own arrival in Cairo. You got there right around this time, right, in 2011. And before that, you had been the New Yorker's correspondent in China. So how did you begin to learn a brand new place when you first got to Egypt? I mean, what do you do?
Yeah, my wife is also a writer. My wife is named Leslie Chang, and she used to write for the Wall Street Journal. And so both of us, like living overseas, she was also in China for more than a decade. And so actually, when we left China in 2007, we had this idea that we would like to go to another place and study another language and write about another part of the world. And we thought about it a lot, and we decided it was actually either going to be Damascus or Cairo. Those were the two choices. And this was back in 2007, and people told us, you know, actually nothing changes in Cairo. It's very sleepy. It's, you know, Mubarak's been in power for almost 30 years. You may find it boring, and which was fine. We liked the idea of going there and studying Arabic. But of course, by the time we were ready to make the move, the Arab Spring began. And so this unexpected event. And so we ended up going to a country that was very different from what we had expected. And it was very intense. I mean, so when you ask what we do to undertake something like this, I think the first thing was really language, you know, and so we enrolled in an intensive Arabic class, the Middlebury summer program, did 2 months of intensive Arabic. And once we arrived in Cairo, we really focused on language. That was very important, obviously, just for understanding the place, but also for safety. You know, I was often dealing with crowds, and you're in somewhat volatile situations. And if you can speak some Arabic, it really helps.
So you mentioned getting there and that you sort of saw the fall as the fall of a weak state, which reminds me of something you write in this book. And I wonder if it's informed by the perspective you gleaned from all those years in China, because you write that, quote, the Chinese saw Egypt for what it was, not for what they hoped it might become. During the first phase of the Egyptian Arab Spring, Westerners usually believed that they were witnessing the rise of a powerful social movement, whereas the Chinese tended to see the collapse of a weak state. So is that where that comes from that Chinese perspective you picked up?
Yeah, it was partly. And this was one of the reasons we went there, is we felt like, you know, you often specialize in a place, but it's nice to have actually three different cultures that you're thinking about and three different languages. And so we thought, having come to Egypt from China, it meant that my perspective is not just that of an American, of a Westerner. I also have quite a bit of Chinese perspective, because I was there for, you know, 11 intense years. I speak Chinese fluently. So it colors the way I see things. And I also got to know Chinese who had migrated to Egypt and who were working there and who were living very much at the grassroots level in small cities in Upper Egypt. And talking to them was really fascinating to me. And that's part of what gives this book, I think, a different perspective, because I was hearing from them as well as from the Egyptians and as well as from whatever foreigners and Americans who were there.
I think one of the other things that gives the book a different perspective is the types of characters who you interview for this book. I mean, there's a lot of government officials and protesters who are the sort of people we would expect to see as you're covering a political revolution. But you've also got these very, I think, personal and revealing stories within there about the interactions you have in your everyday life with people like the neighborhood garbage man or your translator who is living in the closet out of fear, your Arabic teacher who has this nostalgia for the way things were. So I'm curious how you sort of navigated that line between someone being a reporting subject or a source and then maybe bleeding over into a friendship.
You let the reader know what your relationship is, you know. So if this is and I like having a number of my stories, a number of my subjects develop spontaneously. You know, to me that's always an important part of my process, is not to pick subjects or things too far in advance. It's often what strikes you as interesting. And the garbage man, I became interested in him because he was bringing me things from the garbage that he would take out of, you know, he would find these things in the garbage of foreigners and other people and things that were in English and things that were in Chinese. And he would bring them to me and ask me, you know, what is this? Can you tell me what this medicine is used for and so on? And so I got interested. I realized he's going through this stuff in an incredibly intricate way. What's going on here? And so I started looking at the system, and it turned out it really actually said a lot about how Cairo functions and also about, you know, the culture of people from Upper Egypt, because that's where his family was originally from. And so many Egyptians have this background. And it turned into something that was a friendship, but he was also a writing subject. And he taught me a great deal about the country.
Well, I'd love it if you'd read a little bit about what you wrote about your relationship with Saeed, this garbage man that you're describing. And I'll just give it a little bit of a background. So this scene is as he's preparing you to watch a soccer match with him with a group of his friends who are mostly Coptic Christians. He's Muslim, and he's walking you through the mechanics of how you should go about addressing him. So would you pick it up there?
Yeah, and another thing that I would mention is the reason that this is complicated is that, so he's Muslim. Many garbage collectors in Cairo are Christian, and the reason that is the case is because they could have pigs, and the pigs could process the organic matter from the garbage. And so it's this really amazingly intricate niche that's culturally and religiously specific. So that's why this is charged. But I'll read you what I wrote here. Like so many aspects of Egyptian society, the garbage world involved endless complexities of social class, faith, and language. The first time Saeed invited me to his neighborhood to watch a soccer game with his Zebalin colleagues, most of whom were cops, he prepped me carefully. He warned me not to say Salamu Alaikum to a Christian, and he reminded me to address any priest as Abuna, or Father. At all costs, I should avoid using Muslim interjections like La ilaha illallah, there is no God but God. I enjoyed the strangeness of this exchange, the Muslim garbage man instructing the former Catholic altar boy on how to avoid offending Coptic Christian sensibilities.
I mean, it is kind of funny and strange in a way, but also sort of makes sense because you get an appreciation for the difference of culture, that just because maybe you were a Catholic altar boy at one time doesn't mean you understand Coptic Christians in Egypt. Is that sort of what makes you isolate this scene for us?
Yeah, no, I think it's, and it was also just funny how, it was amazing how aware he had to be. This was really his job. He's picking up garbage, and a lot of people think this is a low job, but it was intensely political, actually. Because first of all, he's a Muslim. Most of the people he's working with are Christians. He has to learn, you know, to be respectful of them, to understand their traditions. And so he had to negotiate that side. He was also kind of an amazing situation because he was not paid. There was no set fee for his work, which is one of the reasons why, for me, it struck me, because the first time he came to collect the bill for the month, I said, how much is he? He's like, how much do you want to pay? And then we started, and I said, well, how much do other people pay? Oh, sometimes they pay 10, sometimes they pay 100. There's a huge range. And it's like, he couldn't get him to narrow it down. And then I realized later, well, it's because his job just depends. If he does a good job and he can inspire you to feel obligated, you pay him. But there is no legal obligation. It's a totally informal system. And actually, many things in Egypt are like this. And it's sort of amazing that it functions. But that's also one reason why it's hard to change, because, you know, like 65% of the people in Cairo live in illegal housing. I mean, these are neighborhoods that are unplanned, basically unmonitored by the state. you know, you have a regime that we think of as authoritarian, but they often have actually very little authority on the ground. And a lot of people just kind of live lives that are disconnected from the state. It makes it hard to change, actually. It makes it hard to have a revolution, you know, when people are just used to doing their own thing.
You know, the pay what you want model, Peter, sounds a bit like public radio. This is what we do with our listeners, right? It's free to listen if you want, but we'd love for you to give, you know.
Yeah, but the garbage doesn't accumulate otherwise, which that's is sometimes right. What would happen. Like, sometimes people, like, if a landlord in a building was having some conflict with a tenant, he would pay Saeed not to pick up the person's garbage.
Really?
Yeah, you know, to get leverage on him. And then once he'd get once the dispute had been settled, then he would pay Saeed to pick it all up. So it was very complicated, but it's really informal. And that's why it was amazing that this guy was in the middle of this very complicated cultural situation.
So within your book, you sort of jump back and forth between different settings and different time periods. Some of the book takes place at these archaeological digs in Upper Egypt, which is actually what I remember from reading your initial New Yorker piece in 2013 by the same title, The Buried. Is that sort of what got the ball rolling? And then how did you sort of expand it out to being a full book?
Yeah, I've always been interested in archaeology, and actually in China, I wrote quite a bit about it as well. One of the things I feel when you're in these cultures with incredible ancient history is you do see a lot of connections. And it gives you a different perspective on what's going on now. And especially, this was such an intense political period to be there. You know, we arrived sort of in the wake of Mubarak's fall. I wasn't there when Mubarak was toppled, but that year we showed up. And so we were there for the first election and then the coup and all the other things that happened. And it can be, you know, you can get a kind of tunnel vision. Sometimes on what's happening right now. It's all Muslim Brotherhood. It's all the military. And one of the nice things about going to the archaeological sites and spending time with the Egyptologists was it sort of forced me to step back a bit. And these were very peaceful places, too. There's no crowds. There's no chanting. You're in the desert. You know, you're looking at this, you know, these incredible wastes and these archaeologists working very slowly, very methodically. It's, you know, it's very powerful. And they're uncovering evidence of these cultures, you know, from thousands of years ago. And one of them, for example, was a pharaoh named Akhenaten. And I would visit Barry Kemp, who was excavating Amarna, which was the capital that Akhenaten built. And he was like history's first revolutionary, some people say, because he radically tried to change the Egyptian faith, which had been stable for more than a millennium. This is in the 14th century BC. He decided, basically, it's the first time in recorded history that an individual takes a step toward monotheism. He wants to worship one god. And this was incredibly disruptive to the country. He built a new capital, and he tried to change the artistic patterns, all of these things. So it's basically like another example of a revolution. But when you look at it, you know, from the perspective of somebody in 2013, 2014, and when everything is going on in Tahrir, you really see these connections. You know, you see, and how did it end? It ended with the head of the military staging what may be the first coup in recorded history and taking over and ending that dynasty, which is kind of what we saw in 2013 when the Muslim Brotherhood year in power ended with a coup by the Minister of Defense, Sisi. The thing about the ancient Egyptians, we focus on the pyramids and all of these amazing monumental constructions, and that's natural. They are stunning. But, in some ways, their real genius was political. I mean, they were brilliant politicians. They were really good at creating a sense. I mean, first of all, just to have the sense of a nation is not something that people really had before the Egyptians, the sense that this is a people defined by a territory. We are one people. We are the Egyptians, you know, and they created this powerful sense, the sense of a divine ruler. You know, many of these symbols that to us are very familiar, like the crown, the scepter, these are things that the Egyptians, you know, pioneered, basically. It's believed that they were the first ones to develop these symbols. They used to have where the pharaoh lived, they would whitewash it, and they called it the white wall, you know, which is just like the White House. You know, they understood architecture is symbolic. You build the pharaoh's building, you paint it white, you put it where everybody sees it. You know, you have something that's a focal point. They use nostalgia in brilliant ways. They were always declaring, you know, for example, that after that pharaoh, Akhenaten, was overthrown, one of the ones who came after him, actually the next one who came after him, declared what they called a wehemesut, which is a renaissance, you know, which is we're going back. We're going back to the real Egypt. And this was something that pharaohs would often do after a period of instability. And it's the exact same thing. After Mubarak was overthrown and the Muslim Brotherhood came to power, they declared a Nahda, which in Arabic means renaissance. And it's not that different from what we have. I mean, we're sort of, you know, have a revolutionary figure now, and it's Make America Great Again. It's the same thing. We go back. You know, it's a way of justifying change, justifying a degree of radicalism through the past. You know, and this is a very sophisticated political strategy that they were using, you know, 3,000 years ago, and we still use it today.
How does your time then in Egypt and maybe in China as well inform how you see what's going on in American politics today?
It's familiar, you know, to some degree. I mean, I think this sense of nostalgia you know, that's very familiar. I think also the authoritarian, the power, you know, the appeal of a strong ruler, of a strong man is really fundamental. You know, it's visceral. You know, this is something that we like to think that, you know, we're democratic, that we have moved beyond these sort of kind of crude manipulations that people were doing thousands of years ago, but it still really grabs people. You know, this idea, and I would talk to the archaeologists and they would say, you know, I've been working on this dig and looking at this pharaoh's history, and then when I see Sisi coming up, and it makes me think about this endless appeal of the strong male ruler, you know, and I feel that here often as well.
That's Peter Hessler. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker, and his new book is called The Buried, An Archaeology of the Egyptian Revolution. Peter, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, how are you and your garden dealing with this weather? We'll take your calls next, 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston.